Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
I'm Marty Kine, and this is Paleo Ed Tech. And today I am delighted to welcome Jonah Goodhart to the program. Along with his brother Noah, Jonah has been part of the ad tech story since the 1990s. As a college student, he started a company called Colonize. It became one of the biggest customers of DoubleClick's media division, Sonar. And after the dot-com crash, Jonah and his brother invested in Right Media, which became the first exchange. They later founded Moat in 2010, sold it to Oracle in 2017. I've become very interested in the entrepreneurial mindset. You're clearly an entrepreneur by nature. Did you have entrepreneurs in your family? I mean, were your parents entrepreneurs or what?
My parents were both teachers, are both teachers. My father was a professor of philosophy and religious studies and English. My mother was an early childhood education teacher. She eventually went on to be a social worker. So no, teachers were my parental influence, but my oldest brother, Josh was an entrepreneur, and he was really, we were close. I have two brothers, Noah, the one that I started a couple of businesses with, and Josh, and all the three of us are, you know, only a couple of years apart in age. And when Josh was at Cornell University, he started a newspaper. This is in the mid 1990s, but he actually started a newspaper to compete with the school paper. And he called it The Globe. He ended up moving to Atlanta and starting a magazine called Jezebel Magazine, which was really successful and is still around today.
So you were at Cornell when you got involved with Colonize. Where did that idea for that come from? And what was the business that you were in there?
Yeah, so I was an undergraduate at Cornell. I was working at the computer center. I didn't own a computer, so I was making $5 an hour as an employee, helping people print their papers and control alt delete their computer system and
reboot.
And my brother and I, Noah, who was a couple years older than me, was graduating Cornell. I think he had actually started a graduate program at Yale at the time. And we were talking about how the internet was taking off, how companies were going public, how just a tremendous amount of value was being created. And what happened was we noticed that there were companies being valued based on the number of email addresses they had in their database. And so there was a company called Free Shop at the time, which was a billion-dollar plus public company. Another company called Postmaster Direct, which I think became named Net Creations later on again. Billion-dollar plus company, and they were being valued at $100 per email address. And so here I am as a kid making $5 an hour of work, seeing that having one email was apparently worth $100. And so
20 hours. Wow.
My brother and I thought, wow, there's an interesting opportunity here. We should do something, and maybe there's a business here. We didn't know what we were ultimately getting into, but what we did at the time was we put up a website. And we said to friends of ours, hey, if you give us your email, we'll send you links to deals, to giveaways, to cool sites. As the internet, if you remember, Yahoo was super popular in the very early stages because it was essentially a directory of the internet. This is before there was a great search engine in Google, so it was hard to find things. And so one of the things that we did is we went and sort of looked around the web and found cool deals, cool offers. And at the time, it happened to coincide with e-commerce companies coming online. And so companies like Buy.com and Barnes & Noble and PayPal and others began a business model where basically they were giving away really phenomenal offers, phenomenal deals, like your first purchase at Buy.com is free, as an example, up to $20. Literally all you had to do was know where to find these deals and sign up. And so we started kind of collecting these sorts of things and sending them to friends. Like I said, we put up a website to collect people's email addresses and literally just had a newsletter. We weren't making any money at this point, and it wasn't a business. It was just something we were doing for fun. And we had sent out an email talking about Barnes & Noble and telling the people on our list how you could get basically free stuff at Barnes & Noble. And I got a call because at that time, there was no privacy around domain names. So my name and my phone number was on the domain name if you looked it up. And somebody from Barnes & Noble called me. And in short, he said, Hey, I see that you're sending out these links to our store. And at first I thought, as a, 20-year-old college kid, maybe I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble with Barnes & Noble here. And he said, actually, it's great. He said, but the problem is we can't track that you're doing it. If you add this link to this code to the end of your link, we can actually pay you for every person that ends up coming to Barnes & Noble and making a purchase as a result of the email you sent. And we thought, that's interesting. So we immediately added what we would later learn was, in essence, an affiliate code to our links. We resent out the same emails to the same list and almost instantly saw people converting and making purchases and logged into our Barnes & Noble account and noticed that there was money there. And it was like magic. And we were hooked from that moment on. We sort of realized in practice the power of the internet. And I think from there we thought, all right, I wonder if other brands besides Barnes & Noble are willing to pay us for sending them customers. And sure enough, they would. And colonize our business was born. The problem we had at the time, though, was we didn't have very many emails. So we just had friends and friends of friends. We had tried to test some advertising by buying other email newsletters, the cool site of the day newsletters, as an example, and had a little bit of success, but not at any kind of scale. And this was the point at which we met Mike Walrath.
So the website you had up was called colonize.com. Is that right?
Colonize.com. Yeah. We built different landing pages. So depending on, the offer and whether we ended up building all sorts of content from our own cool site of the day to daily recipes to all sorts of stuff to
attract bargains, people to your site,
to attract people. And we knew that ultimately there was a path to monetization because once people got our newsletters, we could show them these offers from e-commerce, predominantly e-commerce companies. And when they transacted, we got paid. That's right. And so the numbers sort of made sense to us and it made sense. We didn't realize that was what we would now call customer acquisition. Yeah. We didn't realize that what we were in fact doing was acquiring customers for partners on a cost per customer basis and that we were in essence taking their media risk and just delivering them their customers. But that's what it eventually, of course, turned into. And I think when, the Mike Walrath sort of part of the story is serendipitous because Mike cold calls.
Because Mike was working at DoubleClick at the time.
Sales guy at DoubleClick. That's right. Sales guy at DoubleClick. This is, now late 90s, maybe beginning of 2000. And he sees one of our emails, one of our newsletters, and he literally gets me on the phone and says, have you ever thought about buying banner ads? And, at the time, all we knew about banners is that they were on every website. But for the most part, it seemed like they were big companies that were doing business for banners. It seemed expensive was sort of my takeaway. And even if we wanted to try advertising using banners, eventually called display, we wouldn't know how to do it. And Mike said, I work at this company called DoubleClick. And, while we mostly sell our ads to brand advertisers, and I remember reading an article at the time about Wenda Harris Millard, this sort of big name in the brand world, and how she was running sales for DoubleClick. And we thought, wow, there's no way we can afford any of this. This doesn't make any sense for us. Mike said, there's actually a lesser known division of DoubleClick, which focuses on remnant inventory or unsold inventory. And that inventory you can buy at a far less price if you're flexible and if you approach things in a bit of a different way, meaning you have hard actions that you're trying to drive and so on and so forth.
This was Sonar, his group that he was working.
I don't even think it was called, I think Sonar eventually became what it was called, but I don't even know that it was called that in the super early days. But Mike sort of proposed something, which was, look, test it out. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, then no problem. And we thought, okay, cool. And I remember, we gave him an Amex card that we had gotten and we'd built our initial business Colonize without raising any money. It was just literally on credit cards. And we swiped it for $5,000 with DoubleClick. He ran our first ads over the weekend. I think we actually created the initial versions of our ads. I don't remember exactly what the ad said, but we were playing with different copy. I think one of them, we wrote something like hey, George Costanza, looking for the best deals online or something. We didn't know anything about copywriting or copyright for that matter.
He did a Seinfeld allusion.
Seinfeld reference, something like that. Okay. And we ran it. And what we saw was that it worked in literally that first weekend. It drove people to our website. They signed up for our newsletters. And I think for that $5,000 spend, we generated something like $17,000 in revenue. And so again, I'm still working at the computer center and I don't still own a computer at this point. And so all of a sudden we're going, huh, this is very, very interesting. I don't know what we've just tapped into here, but there's something really exciting. So let's go.
So you're still in college. You're a student.
Still in college. Yeah.
Are you going to classes and doing your homework?
Less so at that point. You know, I think
you're running a business.
I think I switched, you know, we got an office in downtown Ithaca. I think I switched as many of my classes to pass fail as I could. But, you know, I was on full financial aid at Cornell. Cornell has a great program for financial aid where it's called need-based. So once you get in to the school, if you get in, they basically make a commitment that they'll figure out a way to pay for it. And so I got a scholarship. You know, I had to work for the summers and had maximum government loans and all of that. But then I was given a scholarship. And so when we started suddenly kind of making money, it was somewhat of a shock to us. And, you know, but yeah, we were still in school. We ended up paying off all of our loans. And right about the time that I graduated, we were off and running with this business.
So how did Mike eventually find out that you were just kids?
So Mike and I would talk all
young
the time.
Young man, I'll say young
yeah,
man.
Yeah, we would talk all the time and we would talk for hours, but I kept it very professional. We talked about, you know, ad campaigns, optimization strategies, and we talked about, you know, life. It wasn't that we didn't talk philosophy and that sort of thing, but we didn't get into, you know, how old are you? Or do you have, you know, you? I think he said, do you have kids? And I said, no, I don't have kids. And at the time, it wasn't necessarily thought of as sort of in vogue to be a young person running a company the way, of course, it is now. And so the way I think he actually found out was I was going to class one day. I think I was taking a final exam and I took the final, come back to our office in downtown Ithaca. We had someone who worked at the office who answered phones for us. And she said, hey, someone named Mike Walrath has been desperately trying to reach you about some sort of campaign issue going on, and he really wants you to call him back. And I said, oh, okay. What did you tell him? And she said, oh, I told him you were in a final. And I said, oh,
busted.
All right. Oh boy. So he knew at that point I was in college, and he certainly didn't let me forget that either. But I think we bonded over it at the time.
Well, you were a very good customer of his, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of these banners, though, were you always the creative force behind them, or did you eventually get creatives involved?
We made them in-house. My brother was more creative than I was, is more creative visually. Than I am visually, for sure. He was also the coder. He did actually the coding of our initial sites and wrote, you know, PHP and JavaScript and that sort of thing. And so he was the one that handled most of that. I was the business person. I was doing the optimization. I was trying to understand how to make the numbers work, maintaining the relationships with the brands and that sort of thing.
So you mentioned the .com crash, of course, that started in early 2000 and then continued and, you know, it was around for a bit. What was the impact of that on your business?
Virtually destroyed our business. That was the impact. Our
pretty big
was,
impact, I guess.
It was pretty big. Our business was predicated on taking media risk and being able to drive customers to brands on a cost per customer basis. So a customer would typically name the price and we would then say, okay, it works or it doesn't work. And in order for that to work, we needed basically good creative, good ads that got consumer attention. And we needed people to take an action. And in order to encourage people to take an action, brands were offering, you know, these great deals. So again, first purchase at pets.com or buy.com or essential.com or drugstore.com were very sort of compelling. PayPal literally gave away money. They said $5 free for making any transfer at all. We'll literally just send you money. And when the world changed with the .com crash, what happened was brands changed their business model. They suddenly said, hey, we can't give, you know, your first purchase free. What we can do is instead of your first purchase, we'll give you, you know, $5 off a $150 purchase. And for a consumer that was getting, you know, free $20 worth of stuff, that suddenly didn't sound so good. And so the attention dropped, conversion rates dropped, our business. I think 70 or 80% of our clients went away in a year, something in that order of magnitude, or cut back dramatically.
So the crash happened and your business is not doing well. Were you considering then going to business school or law school or something like that? Or were you committed to staying in the ad business?
You know, I was committed to staying in business in some form. You know, what I would say is that the business stayed alive. It didn't die. So that was also a good lesson. Like you can sort of scale things back and still figure out a way to maybe make it work at some level. But it had dramatically changed. And I think when, you know, this is around 2002, at this point, when DoubleClick had announced that they were getting out of the media business, that they would sell that business to L90 and form this company, Max Worldwide. When Mike called me and said, hey, I think there's an opportunity to trade media more effectively and efficiently. And so my brother and I went out to dinner with Mike. We went to Houston's on 26th and Park, which I think is called something else now. But there's still a restaurant there.
That space is still there. Yeah.
The space is still there. And we talked about what Mike was thinking to do. And he said, look, I'm going to launch a company. I don't want to stay with Max Worldwide through this, you know, long term. I'm going to do my own thing. And I think there's an opportunity to create something more efficient. And one thing that we knew about Mike, first of all, was that he was a straight shooter. He was someone that we had worked with for a couple of years at that point, that we knew, that we trusted. But we also understood that media was our largest expense for Colonize. And so we had this sort of feeling that, huh, if we could own a piece of the business on the other side of the house, then that would help whatever we end up doing on the media buying side, owning a piece of the media selling side, in effect, or the technology that powers that is super interesting. So, you know, after that dinner, we cut a check to Mike for $250,000. It was our first real investment with money that we had made from Colonize. So we didn't have any other money. We joined his board. We became one of his first clients. And, you know, he had made his first couple hires and Right Media was off and running.
Yeah, it's a legendary moment, that meeting at Houston's. Was it just the three of you?
It was just the three of us. Yeah, it was a napkin moment. It was literally. Yeah. And I think for me, it was really interesting to hear him talk about, you know, if we envision a world where consumers continue to adopt digital, then we'll start to see these types of things happen. And what I know to be the case is that more people will focus on advertising and digital, not less, as long as consumers continue to be there, that sort of thing. And I thought, wow, this guy really has a way of understanding the business world and a way of kind of talking about where the future is. Yeah. And we got excited and thought we got to be a business with him and partner with him in some capacity here.
Now, Right Media became known as a network. It was an ad network.
That's right.
Yeah, exchange. I mean, it was an ad network, but what did he actually pitch you? I mean, what was the...
Yeah, prior to an exchange, it was an ad network in essence. Yeah. I mean, it was literally taking, in sort of simplest terms, it was taking the media buying that we were still doing at Colonize and running it through him instead of running it through other companies. So we had four or five companies that we were working with at the time. And basically the pitch was run that media spend through us, and we'll make it more efficient. We'll drive more outcomes for you. We'll do a better job and you'll spend the same or, you know, more money if it works, but it won't hurt you. It'll be a net good thing. And so he was talking about trading inventory in a more effective, efficient way. He did talk about marketplace models like eBay, and he talked about auction models like GoTo at the time. But I don't think it was ever presented to us as an exchange until a bit later on in the company's history that concept really became real.
Yeah, when Brian O'Kelly came along, and that was not in the very beginning, but it was a little bit later.
That's right. Yeah, I think Brian joined as a consultant in the Poindexter office, famous, you know, windowless closet.
The
closet office. And Brian had an ability to build. And Mike had an ability to have a vision and to get people on board and bring people along and sell, frankly. And so the combination of Mike and Brian was really special for several years.
Yeah, no, Right Media is legendary.
You know, Mike was very smart. One of the things that Mike, I think, understood that others didn't was the ability to both be very micro and macro. So Mike could literally log in and optimize a campaign by hand, but then he could also talk about at a macro level where the space was going and the challenges that needed to be solved. And so I think in building Right Media, for sure, there was a part of it, which was, all right, how do we take inefficiencies out of the system? And, you know, at some level, interestingly, with an auction, if done right, the value and the price you pay kind of approach each other, which is not always a good thing from a marketer perspective, right? And so if you think about it through this lens, if I'm buying inventory at a dollar and I'm making $3 on it, I'm pretty happy. If you control that auction system and you go, well, you're paying a dollar, but you would be willing to pay more for it because you're making three, all of a sudden there's sort of a systemic approach to raise price. Yeah. And so one of the things that we saw in the auction environment was our media buying was less efficient, actually. We maybe got more scale and it was easier to control, and there were settings and all sorts of other great things that happened. But our actual profitability per unit sold, per unit served, if you will, actually went down as auctions and marketplaces came into effect. And so I think there's all these interesting dynamics. I think it was a net positive thing because when our efficiency went down, it meant that publisher efficiency went up, which was good. It also meant that other people came into the market to compete. And so I think all of those types of auction dynamics and marketplace dynamics were really positive, but it's something that people don't always understand or talk about, is that if you can buy something in X and sell it for a multiple of that, and somebody says, we're going to make this more efficient, that's not always a good thing for the person who's the buyer.
It might make the arbitrage a little bit more difficult.
That's right.
By having an open market. Yeah. So Yahoo acquired Right Media, of course. Were you surprised by that deal?
Yahoo had made an investment in Right Media, right, as you probably know, and they were on the board and I was on the board. And so, you know, I was sitting in the room with Todd Tressi, who was the Yahoo representative, and the Redpoint representative, the investor that had invested in Right Media, and Mike and my brother Noah. And we were talking about sort of where's the space go and where are things evolving and what are we seeing in the market and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I knew inherently that yes, Yahoo was interested in the space. They'd made the investment. We didn't know how things would transpire when Google bought DoubleClick, a deal that Yahoo had bid on. I think it created an environment for a deal to get done. I also, if I recall correctly, remember that Mike worked pretty closely with the DoubleClick team on their strategy around building an exchange. And I know that he had met with them and talked with them and had sort of thought through as a potential partner of that business. And I think that ended up being not only good validation for Right Media, but it ended up, in a sense, creating a competitor. But by doing that, it also created the necessity for Right Media to be part of someone that wanted to compete with that company. So I always thought that was a very smart move by Mike in sort of validating, in essence, the market that he was in by helping DoubleClick figure it out. And I think he did it, you know, with the intention of partnering with DoubleClick in some capacity. But when they eventually built their own exchange and said, okay, we're going to do this on our own, that wasn't a bad thing for Right Media either.
Yeah, they ended up building and launching AdX, Google's ad exchange. And then Yahoo, if they wanted to compete credibly with Google, needed their own exchange, and Right Media had that. So
that's right. The big question, though, and I remember talking with Todd, he may not even remember this at this point, but I remember talking with Todd Tresti about this at Yahoo, which was, are exchanges just for remnant inventory? Is that what an exchange is? Is it just the unsold, you know, quote unquote, junk inventory that you don't sell? And it's just a way to get a couple more pennies on that inventory. And I think, you know, Todd's view was it is more of that. And it's not necessarily going to be the premium side of the house, at least initially. So we sort of asked the question, all right, well, one, are we positive the brands have to figure out digital? And we sort of decided, yes, there's no choice. They will eventually have to figure out digital because the consumers are there. And so then the only question is how. And our first thought behind this was, it's going to be the creative. We're going to have to reinvent how storytelling is done. And we didn't think we could do that ourselves. We didn't want to build a creative agency. So the idea we came up with, which became the initial version of Moat, was to build a crowdsourced creative marketplace.
So Right Media has been acquired by Yahoo, and you're moving on to the next thing. And I know you're doing some investing and stuff. So you're talking about the formation of Moat here, and it's crowdsourced creative. So what is it about and you raised money for that idea, right? You had a...
Not initially. We self-funded it. And so we were iterating, and we had this idea of a crowdsourced creative marketplace. And I think one of the things that we did as part of this effort was we asked a lot of questions, and we said, okay, so let's assume for a second that we're going to come up with, or our marketplace is going to come up with a great set of ads for brand fill in the blank. How will that brand know that those ads work better than the other ads that they could be running? Because keep in mind, again, this is not some outcome that is easily measurable, at least at that time. And it was a branding event that might take 30 days, 60 days, a year, et cetera. And so how will we be able to measure that? And as part of asking that question, we came up with this idea of, well, maybe there's a set of analytics that we can create. But at the time, all the ads on the internet, banner ads, display ads, were being built in Flash. And so we built analytics that could be embedded in Flash at the time. And we said, okay, we'll build analytics that will travel with the ads and we'll sort of report back, call back home, call us, and let us know how the ad's doing. Is it being seen? Are people interacting with it? So on and so forth. And one of the things that we built as part of that effort was a set of capabilities to measure things like engagement, which we started calling attention. And we built heat maps on how people interacted with the ads. If they were on a desktop computer, if they moused over it, or eventually on a mobile phone, if they touched it. And so we would go into a brand to talk about creative, talk about creative innovation. And we would often come out talking about heat maps and analytics. And it pretty quickly became clear after about a year of doing that, that analytics was our future, not building a creative marketplace. And so we were off and running down that path. At that point was when we raised money.
I see. Okay. So, but the creative outsourcing idea, which is a good idea on its face, why do you think it didn't take off?
I remember I had one meeting, I think it was actually at Microsoft at the time, Microsoft as an advertiser, perhaps. Yeah. And they said, so I get it. You're building a creative marketplace. I get the need for better creative. We agree. So are you replacing our creative agency?
And that's the question.
Oh, that's interesting. No, we're definitely not replacing a creative agency. We're not going to do all the stuff your creative agency does. We're just trying to build you better ads. And they said, okay, so you're not replacing our creative agency. So is it fair to assume this is a net additional cost to our creative agency? And I said, well, I guess if you put it that way, you know,
good question.
We'll give you value, but yeah, I guess this is a net additional cost. And so I learned a valuable lesson there, which is you could have a great idea, but also you have to figure out who pays for it. How do you fit into the market? Are you augmenting something else? Are you replacing something else? And honestly, people got so excited by the heat maps and by the analytics that we felt like there was something special there. The funny thing is we had built, as part of our crowdsourced creative marketplace, we built the search engine at moat.com, which was, we said, well, how do we even know what the ads currently look like? If we're going to go pitch somebody on building better ads, you got to know what they currently look like. And there was no Google search included. There was no easy way to find what ads a brand was running. And so we built a system to basically go out and find ads for every brand and automatically put them in the search engine. So you could search by the name of the brand and instantly see in real time what their ads looked like. And that was what became our search engine, which we thought was going to feed the marketplace. And it eventually just helped get our name out there as a company. And, yeah, you know, 100,000 people a month used it. And it became sort of this really cool capability, which ultimately was an entree into us building an analytics business. But for sure, we didn't know that's what
it was. Yeah. I mean, that was a stroke of genius and also extremely useful. I was at an agency myself at the time, and we wanted to see the creative that the competitors were doing and the different formats they were using, and then different ideas from other brands that we admired. And that was your brand building tool. So you said you raised money. Did you set out to raise a lot of money and build a big business, or what was your kind of scope here?
No, I mean, we had been having conversations. We had met Ron Conway through Mike Walrath, and we had met a couple of folks that had said, oh, you know, I heard you guys were sort of involved with Right Media, and, you know, that you're working on something, would love to hear about it, and that sort of thing. We ended up deciding, all right, well, let's take some money from angels. And so Ron and a handful of other angel investors invested in 2011. And we said very clearly, look, we think we're onto something, but we don't know exactly what the business is. We haven't generated a penny of revenue at this point. And so we don't know exactly what the model is going to be. We think it's something, you know, in analytics, but we'll see. By 2012, we were starting to get a little bit of traction with analytics. We were starting to get people doing pilots. Forbes was our first one. AOL was our second. Kellogg's on the brand side was starting to have conversations with us.
Was this related to viewability? Was it attention?
So we were going in talking about attention, and what we saw happen was there was an announcement made at an IAB leadership meeting about viewability. And this sort of stat was put out there that half the ads that are bought are never seen. And we thought, huh, that's super interesting because we're focused on attention, but you can't have attention if the ad wasn't there. And so you got to start with viewability perhaps, and then ultimately it has to go beyond viewability. It has to be more than just it being there. It has to be about driving an impact. And so we ended up really getting into viewability specifically. And I remember, you know, Forbes said to us, who was our first client, look, if you can build the tech to not have analytics go inside the ad, but can wrap around it using JavaScript, we'll launch you on Forbes and you can look at all of our inventory with us and help us figure out how to solve this problem that may be coming around viewability and how to ultimately focus on attention and sort of what comes next. And so that suddenly became our focus, starting with publishers and really building technology from the ground up. I know in 2013, viewability, I think, started to certainly come onto the scene in a big way. Yeah. And then I think by 2014, we knew it was going to be a core of what we did in the Media Rating Council, this nonprofit group that does auditing for measurement companies, had come out with a set of standards for viewability. And we went to them and went through an audit, and we were the first company to be MRC accredited for both display and online video at the time. And so we were in it at that point, and we're off to the races. So in our mind, not just measuring viewability, which again was just the beginning of the conversation, but focused on how do we understand human attention and where does that ultimately take us?
Get your name out there.
So how did the Oracle acquisition happen? We did speak to Omar Tawakkol, and he was at Oracle at the time. Did he bring you in there? And do you know what the vision was for Mode and how it would fit in with the data cloud?
Yeah, Omar did not. Omar, in essence, co-founded the data cloud when he sold BlueKai to Oracle. Okay. And I was lucky enough to be an investor in Omar's, in that company, in BlueKai. Actually, Redpoint had introduced us to him. But he was actually, I didn't know this at the time, but he was soon going to be on his way out. And
ready to leave,
and a new person took over, and that new person was Eric Rosa. So Eric Rosa had built a company called Datalogix. Exactly. They were going public, and right before they went public, they did a deal to be acquired by Oracle. And I knew Datalogix a little bit because I had seen them in market. I had seen them talking about measurement, and I had seen them talking about independent measurement, which was something that I very much still believed in, which is if you are going to be the company that helps understand what happened, you can't sell the media or be the buyer of the media. You need to be independent in that view. And so Datalogix certainly was, and they got bought by Oracle. And I met Eric shortly after that at a conference, I think. And he told me about what they were doing. He told me about what Datalogix did and what they were building. And it sounded pretty compelling, but we didn't do much at the time. We just sort of met, had a conversation. We talked about maybe working together in some capacity. And it was actually one of the lessons that I learned about M&A for entrepreneurs is most of the time, occasionally not, but most of the time, these deals take a couple of years. It's building relationships, understanding, you know, what people's goals are, what they're trying to do, and how you might be able to support that. And we didn't know that we wanted to sell. We didn't plan to sell. Eric eventually, after knowing him for a couple of years, showed up and said, hey, if you're interested in exploring this route, we'd like to talk to you about it. And we said, well, we're open to hearing about it. We had investors, we had shareholders, we had employees who would have life-changing impact if we did something like this. So of course, we're gonna hear them out. We ended up running a short process at the time, got term sheets from multiple companies, and decided in the end that Oracle was the right fit. But really, it was specifically about the Oracle Data Cloud and the group that Eric was running. And Eric was our champion. He was the visionary that got excited about what we were doing, and we got excited about what he was doing, and we decided to make a deal.
So what are you up to these days? Anything exciting you?
A lot, actually. Yeah. So when I left Oracle, I stayed for almost 3 years, just under, and my brother left a little while after being there. Him and I started talking, and we talked about the moments in our career when we were both the happiest. And for me, I always think about Well, you know, colonized, there was joy and despair, right?
Pain.
When the dot-com bubble burst. And for me, I'm most happy when I'm building, when I'm in the stage of trying to see a market, trying to figure out if there's an opening, trying to figure out if there's something that we can do. And not only sort of the theoretical part of it, the actual doing, actually meeting with people and starting to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And we decided to launch a venture studio called Montauk Labs. And Montauk Labs is on a mission to launch companies that have a positive impact on the world using technology, if you will, technology for good. And so we've built some early stage software in the healthcare space around predictive analytics and AI. And, you know, maybe not a surprise to some after 25 years in the ad industry, but we are working on a new company in the measurement space. And so my view is that we're in the midst of measurement revolution of sorts, and we're just at the beginning. So what we're working on is a platform that will help brands leverage multiple measurement solutions or signals across different measurement companies, combined with media and creative signals, and optimized towards brand-defined outcomes.
Does it have a name, or is it early?
It's early. Mobian.
Okay. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Mobian is like was Mobius inspired. It's inspired by the Mobius strip and really inspired by my father. So my dad wrote a book called Mobian Knights, and he talks about how all difference is actually sameness. Thank you. And the Mobius strip, if you can sort of visualize it, is something that looks like it's a figure in mathematics, but it looks like there's two sides to it. And as you sort of get closer to it, you begin to understand that it's actually one continuous side, one continuous loop. Yeah.